Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Hello, and welcome to Still Watching, a television podcast from Vanity Fair. I'm Chris Murphy.
I'm Richard Lawson.
And I'm Hilary Busis. We are here with a special bonus episode for you. It's about, who else? Princess Diana.
Oh, I haven't heard of her, actually. We're going to go back to our watch-along of Season 6 of The Crown when Part 2 drops on Netflix on December 14th. But for this episode, we're going to talk all things Princess Di.
So we were saying in a couple episodes ago that we're kind of sad about Diana being off the show. I mean, we knew this was coming. But she's not off our show. We still want to talk more about Diana because obviously is the most enduring like icon of this whole series, I would argue.
Of the royal family, like, in the 20th century, even.
Yeah.
And like, arguably more so than Queen Elizabeth.
I would say, without a doubt.
Right. And I think that we've talked a lot about, because that's what the show has been about her, like, legacy within the family and, you know, that sort of aspect of her celebrity, if you want to call it that. But we haven't gone a ton into the sort of pop iconography of her. I was actually just doing a New York Times crossword where the clue was, like, Princess Diana and Prince were these, and it was like style icon was the answer.
Wow.
So like, I feel like we haven't done a ton of like deep dive into her fashion and sort of the way that she's been portrayed in other media outside The Crown, of which there is, you know, we've mentioned, of course, the Naomi Watts movie.
But constantly mentioning
even
that
more
movie.
Recently, there's been like not just The Crown, but also the Kristen Stewart movie Spencer and Diana the Musical. The ill-fated Diana the Musical.
Too good for this world, I would say.
Just in the past few years.
A little bit of a Diana renaissance. Yeah, she seems to be like very much having a cultural moment for whatever reason in the last couple of years. That I feel like it's our duty to explore that moment.
So yeah, there's still a lot more to discuss. I hope that you're not sick of Diana because we're not.
We could never be.
This is a bonus episode, which is just an excuse mostly to talk about fashion and the Diana musical.
Yes.
Which I think, you know, look, there have been worse bonus episodes.
I think if you're listening, you're in.
Yeah.
I would hope so.
Click out now if you don't like it.
Yeah, if you don't like hearing about Diana Spencer. But I think especially when it comes to the fashion stuff, the three of us, while very well-dressed people, aren't quite experts exactly, but luckily we work at Vanity Fair, and there are experts. And to that end, we have Vanity Fair's women's wear market editor, Kia Goosby. Kia, hello.
Hi. Hello. Thank you for having me.
So I think it's safe to assume you're a Crown fan.
I am indeed a Crown fan. I've been a loyal follower since season one.
What strikes you most about it? I mean, let's just start from a fashion perspective. How accurate is the show?
I think the show is extremely accurate, and I think The Crown, the costume team that works on the show, does a really amazing job with reinterpreting the outfits just from the Queen to Diana, you know, to the whole family. I think it's impeccably done.
And so with that in mind, like, the show, you know, kind of gets into Diana's status as this, like, pop culture, like folk hero almost. In real life, why exactly was she such a huge icon? And it's connected a lot to what she wore, but why was what she wore, I don't know, like how did she nail style so well?
You know, the thing about it is that I've been thinking about Diana as just kind of like a cultural person. You know, she's someone that was so personable, and her approach to fashion was not done in an unattainable way. And I think that's why she's connected with people from generations after generation. You know, her style has influenced us all. The quiet luxury trend that we've seen in the past couple of years has just resurfaced because she wasn't super flashy, where, you know, in the 80s and 90s, the logos were having a moment, and, you know, you were seeing brands, fashion brands, kind of displayed across chest and lapels and labels and whatnot. And she wore the clothes. They did not wear her. And I think that's a thing that people want to kind of like embody when they put clothes on. They don't want to just be a walking billboard, you know? And I think Diana just really embodied that.
Do you think The Crown has done a thorough enough job of showing that aspect of her, you know, iconography? Like, were you craving more fashion from either the Corrin era or the DeBicki era?
You know, I do think, because looking back at like season 5 to season 6, the minimal 4 episodes that we got closing out the DeBicki era for Diana, I think we could have always had more, you know, but I think it's hard to cram. And I know you guys will talk about, you know, the movies that have been dedicated to Diana, but it would have been nice to kind of see more, kind of just kind of like going into the mindset of just her fashion celebrated. But, you know, it doesn't stop at the show. You know, we could see a retrospect like they've done for Chanel brands, where you can see a moving in-person exhibition of Diana style. I think it's definitely easy and worth recreating, because if you Google image Princess Diana street style, you know, the images are endless. And, you know, when you go back and look at the looks that they chose to recreate in the show, you're like, but there's so many more, you know, like we don't even get into kind of like the way she approached evening wear, hats and like scarves. And then you can talk about, you know, just kind of like that classic minimal style, just like jeans, where she's like, you know, I'm not really affiliated with the royal family, so I'm going to wear pants. You know, they didn't really wear pants.
How
like
shocking.
That.
Wow. Simply isn't that. Yeah.
And so for her to see like jeans and just kind of like slacks in that kind of way, it shows like a modern woman. She doesn't always have to be in a dress. But then when she puts on a dress, she's fabulous. And then when she's on a yacht, she's not in like a simple black swimsuit. She's wearing your leopard print. She just was daring like that.
Something that I love about Princess Diana's style is that it feels like she really could do anything. I mean, she made streetwear iconic with just the big sweater and then the tiny, you know, short shorts. And then like to the revenge dress, right, to the nines, but down to streetwear. Do you have a favorite Diana look? And what do you think about her versatility as a dresser?
Well, I think it gets no better than the revenge dress. I think that's probably one of the most, you know, iconic moments in time. And am I correct? She was going to a Vanity Fair party in London. Is that?
That, like, I think is true. We should double check that.
But yeah, I was hosting it. I'm very old.
But I do think that is true.
Yeah. I mean, it doesn't get any better than that. I mean, the dress, it was designed by Christina Stambolian. And, you know, she was working with a stylist who was a UK editor, Anna Harvey. And I mean, even though she was working with a stylist, I still think Diana was very self-styled. And it was a time when, even though today your average celebrity has a stylist as someone is influencing the decisions that they make, it's really all about the person wearing the clothes. And Diana, when that dress was designed, it was designed years prior to her actually putting it on. And then she wears it for this party. And
it was, in fact, a Vanity Fair party. I just double checked.
Amazing.
Thank you, Hillary.
I love that. And so
look at
she
us.
Puts it on, and, you know, it's off the shoulder. It's black. It's your LBD little black dress. You know, everyone has that in their closet. It's something very simple, but it shows off her body in a way that's like still classy but sexy at the same time. And, you know, I think for someone that obviously a part of the royal family, it's a little bit taboo at that time. But I mean, as you fast forward to fashion today, and, you know, we all saw the images from the Renaissance movie premiere, and you're like,
yes, we
that
did.
Could easily fit well into that event or your Vanity Fair party of 2024. Anyone could easily wear that dress. It's a dress that has aged impeccably well, I think, from when we saw it in 1994 to 2023, which the dress will be celebrating an anniversary next year, ironically. It's a dress that just gets better like fine wine. It really just ages with time. And I think going back to your point about, you know, her high to her low, you know, I think she was the innovator of like early street style. You know, we don't give her enough credit for that. But Diana put clothes on just based on probably her mood and how she was feeling. And, you know, for someone that can just throw on a Harvard sweatshirt, I would love to be able to ask her, like, where does she get that Harvard sweatshirt from? And putting it on with bike shorts and just sneakers. And, you know, she was on the go and she was chic, but just so cool at the same time. And I think it gets no better than that.
There was something kind of defiant about it. You know, you see on the show and also in real life, obviously, like a lot of the other royal women are kind of pulling from the same closet, let's say.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The queen's like always dressed for Easter.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
And doesn't matter the occasion.
You know, and I think nowadays when we have, you know, Duchess Kate and Meghan Markle for a time, like they were in public appearances were much more sort of formal. But do you see Diana's influence anywhere in that or where do you think that the Diana's style influence is most visible today?
I mean, I definitely feel like Meghan and Kate definitely probably borrow off of their mother-in-law, if you will. I think they definitely have to be inspired by her. I mean, how can you not be inspired by her? But on the runways, you see it from brands like, you know, The Row to Gucci. You know, I think brands are still utilizing Diana on their mood boards because I think her style touches back to a point in time where your clothes were kind of utilized to speak a message. And I think whether it was her use of, you know, monochromatic looks with like the bold reds or her soft butter yellows, you know, she was very thoughtful in her selection of clothing. And her clothes served as sort of some sort of brightening up her day or the people's day that she was going to visit children at hospitals or, you know, think her clothes just kind of like served, you know, as was an understatement, but a statement, you know, if for lack of better words.
They projected a mood, you know, and whether that mood was somber or it was, you know, kind of kicky revenge or whether it was casual. Like, I think that was not the, I think one of the fascinating things about Diana, at least as depicted on The Crown, for example, is that she had a way of communicating to the people that they're so obsessed with. And the royals were like, no, there are three channels to do this, and this is not one of them. And she kind of kept defying that. And also, you know, we have all this Diana nostalgia, you know, probably spurred on by The Crown, but also because I think, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, Kia, but like, that era of 90s fashion is like so in vogue right now.
Right?
Like
all
the young people I see, I'm like, you look like kids I went to summer camp with in
90s.
Totally.
Too.
Totally. Yeah.
The biggest pants you've ever seen in your entire life.
Tiny little crop top and a big pant.
They all look like they're in TLC, but that's a separate conversation.
I mean, we can go down on a deep dive on another episode of Still Watching. Hopefully we'll revisit that. But yeah, you know, I think nostalgia is back and it's not going anywhere. And I think that speaks to the innovator that Diana was because she didn't think about the longevity when she was putting those outfits together where it was just like a crisp white blouse and jeans or just your Canadian tuxedo with denim on denim. You know, she wasn't thinking about like, oh, this is going to be something that the kids are going to be looking at 30 years from now, but we are. And we're not ashamed to say that we are, you know. I think it's interesting because, like, brands like, you know, Banana Republic, you're most attainable of them all, Theory, you know, J. Crew. You know, we even saw, like, on when Emma Corrin was playing, you know, she was the first iteration of Diana, and, you know, they brought back the sheep sweater, and that was so iconic for that time. And, you know, Rowing Blazers reissued that, and you could still try to do a Google search and try to find that sweater if you want, you know.
I wore that sweater to Thanksgiving.
And that's a perfect holiday sweater.
It's great.
You know, and so there you are, Hillary. You were inspired by Diana, and you're not letting go of her style. And I don't think anyone is letting go of her style. And the thoughtfulness that she chose in the clothes that she wears is seen and felt through the crown and through the pictures, you know, if you just go back and look at her style.
Still watching. We'll be back in just a moment. When we return, we are going to try to stop Chris from singing Diana the Musical in its entirety.
A pretty, pretty girl. had to. It's my favorite line.
I hope you include that entire thing.
The Run Through with Vogue is where you'll meet all the most exciting people in fashion and culture.
I am Fran Lebowitz, who should be the mayor of New York.
We all support that. We support that.
Very nice.
Nikki.
Yes.
It's been really great being in this beautiful pink room.
All right, Usher, can you hear us?
I can hear you.
All right.
Can you hear me?
We can.
We can.
All right, here we are.
On the podcast, you'll learn how Vogue really works.
Sometimes we'll come in for a second or even third run through until we are AWOC.
Can you tell us what AWOC means?
It means AWOK, Anna Wintour OK.
I'm Cho Minardi.
And I'm Chloe Mel.
And we're the hosts of The Run Through with Vogue, where fashion and culture collide.
Join us. It's AWOC.
Listen and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, we've ventured into the musical part of the episode. You may remember this little Broadway show from lockdown.
Right from the start, how come I seem to be the last to know?
And no, you're not hallucinating. Netflix filmed Broadway's Diana the Musical, and it's been streaming since 2021.
Right by side, serves me right for marrying a Scorpio.
All right, so we've mentioned it already several times. Let's just get into it. Diane?
I kind of want to start, actually, yeah. Richard. Sorry, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but
yeah,
I
no,
want to just quote your review.
Oh, oh I wow. love to be quoted
of
back
Diana
to
Diana the Musical.
Yeah.
Okay.
Let's see if you still stand by this.
You call it a shellacked lump of product born solely of cold, money-minded cynicism.
Wow.
End
Shots
quote.
Fired. Shots fired.
I mean, I rewatched some of it for this. Not the whole thing, I'll confess. I still believe that. I mean, I think that Diana the Musical is such a weird thing because it was meant to be in 2020 on Broadway, but it was at, like, at La Jolla in San Diego the year previous, 2019.
Mm-hmm. It's supposed to open in March of 2020.
Yeah.
So it is, by all means, a modern musical of our sort of current contemporary musical era. And yet, it feels like it could have come out on the West End.
1984.
Before
she even existed.
It's, like, so Cameron McIntosh. It's so Andrew Lloyd Webber.
It's so mega
but,
musical.
Like, not even that good, like not even as good as the worst Andrew Lloyd Webber. It's a shocking piece of work.
Yeah, it pulls directly from the tradition of the 1980s mega musicals that are Miss Saigon, Phantom of the Opera,
which Diana herself was
a big fan of,
a vocal fan of. So but, you could call it intentional. You could call it. Yeah, like a sort of tribute to her in that way, but I don't know if the musical is, like, sophisticated enough to have made that connection.
I think the musical is not sophisticated enough on many levels, in many ways, but after watching it,
You don't like AABB rhyme scheme?
The rhymes are just...
I am no longer nursery, but I do appreciate them. I found rewatching it, because I went to see it on Broadway with my friend Larry, right at the peak of its sort of Rocky Horror Picture Show level, like call and response with the audience.
So you had seen it on Netflix.
I'd seen it on Broadway.
But did you see it on Netflix before you saw it on Broadway?
No, I just went to see it on Broadway.
The Netflix release came before Broadway reopened.
Okay, so I had not seen it before going. Yeah, I just went in.
Yeah, so what's that experience like?
It was so funny. It's one of those things where, and I say this with love, I think Diana the Musical is why people hate musicals unless you love musicals. Like, if you are prone to hate musicals, you see Diana the Musical, you sit there, you're like, this is one of the worst pieces of art I've ever sort of experienced. And as a musical lover, it sort of then sort of wraps all the way back around to a little thing that we like to call camp that we overuse too much. But I do think Diana the Musical
earns that
distinction.
Well, camp has to be unintentional.
It has to be unintentional. That's part of the Susan Sontag.
Because I think watching it, you know, the actors are talented. Gina DeWall is like
so good. Great voice.
Bring the house down. I just was like, oh God, I hope they know that this is dumb and they're just having fun with it being dumb. Like, who's taking this seriously? Like, I'm sure the people who wrote it, Joe DiPietro and the guy from Bon Jovi, whose name is escaping me now, they seem to take it seriously, but, like, I don't know.
The problem is that the musical itself doesn't know. It goes back and forth. There's the James Hewitt scene, which is, like, full-on...
absolute hilarity.
Yeah.
If your prince leaves you wanting more, and royal life is a royal bore, why not score a man of war? Here comes James Hewitt.
This, like,
absurdish.
Intentional kitsch. Which seems like kind of the tone that they should have aimed for, maybe, if they wanted it to be more coherent. But then you whiplash between that and, like, you know, then the queen, like, singing a sad song about, like, duty.
Now she sometimes reflects on her unusual life, and that unusual year she was an officer's wife. She never complained.
And it's like, we're trying to do this now at the end of the show. We just spent 2 hours of, like, I don't know, third grade level, like, poetry and just whiplashing through every event of, like, the past 15 years, and then you're trying to stop the show with, like, a serious ballad and trying to add depth to this character. It just doesn't make any sense.
You would think they would pull more from, because we love a musical about, like, a tragic woman. We love an Evita. Right. We love a musical.
Sunset Boulevard.
Sunset Boulevard, thank you. And you think it would pull more from those traditions and sort of give Diana a little bit of an edge. I'm sort of shocked by how often, like, sort of the only...
How toothless it is.
How toothless, but the only perspective they have on Diana is, well, I'm not that bright, but I look nice.
Right. Well, what's weird is that her opening song is about being underestimated, so it, like, sets her up as this, like, canny, like, behind-the-scenes, like... kind of schemer type, but then the show itself doesn't
deliver on that.
Bear that out at all.
What I find maybe most galling about the show in some ways is it purports to be a peek behind the curtain of the palace, and here's the real story of Diana.
That you've never heard.
Mm-hmm. And it's like, okay, older straight men, gay guys and girls know all about this shit.
We know everything.
Like, you are not telling us anything new.
We can recite every beat.
Come on. It's just like, hey, have you guys heard of this Drag Race show? Like, it's just so, not that Diana is, like, the same thing as that, but, like, it's so presumptuous about what people don't know from one of the most covered people of the last 30 plus years.
It's a bizarre position to take, that there is anything here that is new information.
Yeah. I will say, going live, and once everybody was on the same page as to what the show was, and that it is kind of a mess, it is kind of campy, a little bit of a Rocky Horror Picture Show call and response was happening with it. Like, every time Camilla came out, people would hiss.
Yeah. It was like, how did the actors feel about
this? So I think initially they were like, okay, you're making fun of our art. But then once everybody was laughing together, I know Ro Hartram, who plays Prince Charles, and they loved it because, one, it kept the show running for longer than you would have expected because people kept coming. And there's Diafanas, that's sort of the name of Diana superfans, naturally, of course. And it became sort of a communal thing where it's like the reviews were out. They knew they weren't going to win any Tonys. Like, everyone had said what there was to say about the play. And then to find this sort of new second life for it in terms of, all right, it might not be a high art, but we are aware, we're dealing in sort of lowbrow culture in communion with the audience. It was one of the most electric times I've ever had in the theater. It was
that is so interesting.
Fascinating. It was so much fun.
It's not unlike a public reading of like a National Enquirer article about Diana. Like it's tawdry and it's dumb and it's probably mostly fake. But like, whatever, we all agree to that together.
Yes, we're all on the same page. With
and as long as the actors aren't offended, I guess, because they have to get up there.
They have to get up
there. In front of all these people who are laughing at them.
But the thing is, everyone is so invested in the not the joke of it all, but people do genuinely love Diana. And there are some people who genuinely think it's a good musical. And
well
some of those Diana's. we can
someday you'll be a queen, the loveliest queen we've ever seen.
Better than the wank, a snap is worth money in the bank.
Oh, yeah, the wank one is good.
That's a great line for me.
Obviously, the infamous AIDS patient singing, I may be unwell, but I'm handsome as hell.
Yep.
Diana singing, that's what I get for marrying a Scorpio.
Yes.
Which is at least seems on purpose to be a joke.
Yeah, I think so.
But like Charles holding baby William saying, darling, I'm holding my son. So let me say, jolly well done.
I feel like it took them
10 minutes.
Ten minutes.
With like an online rhyming dictionary.
Yeah, with rhymezone.com open
okay.
the other day. Yeah.
It takes more than 10 minutes to write Thrilla in Manila with Diana and Camilla.
And that's one of those instances where you're like, okay, so they know that this is silly.
Fun.
They
know they're having fun.
They're having fun.
Right.
And once the audience and the performers were all on the same page, it was really, really fun.
Mm-hmm.
And fun is not necessarily good, but you can have a jolly good time.
And one of the great, and I understand scheduling-wise and pandemic-wise why this had to happen, but like it brings to mind, you know, some of the live musicals that the networks have done in recent years. Like, why is there no audience at Diana?
That was so excruciating.
They finished these songs, and Jean Dewall has like just like belted something out, and it's just stony silence, and they just move on to the next thing.
Well,
clear
just also,
lap
you have,
lines.
Yeah, you have no idea what's a joke and what's not because there's no audience there, and so they just kind of they just kind of have to keep going forward, and it's just brutal.
It's brutal, and then what was really brutal, and what really takes you to like galaxy brain is the very end where you're like, okay, they're probably just going to end with the divorce, but you know they're going to have to sort of mention the car crash and her death, and we don't see anything, and it's sort of in the second half of the last song.
If they were really going to do Miss Saigon, they would have crashed a car.
They would have had a big car. They would have had a big, massive, mega musical-ass car, but they didn't do that, thank God. But the end of it was so weird because you're in the middle, like, she's singing her triumphant, like, I'm going to be the best after I divorce the king, and then, boom, headlines, she dies, and then she sort of just, like, walks into headlights, and then everybody else says, and the last line of the show is,
The people who will change the world are not the ones you think will change the world.
You're just like, what happened? Like,
what does that even mean?
What does that mean? Yeah. Where did she go? Like, okay, she died. What? It was just, it's so...
I'm surprised they didn't have a chandelier fall on her head.
Well, you may not recall this because it's a very clever callback, but it's a callback to the end of Act 1 when they say the stories girls are taught to believe are not the stories that girls should believe.
Again, the lyricism here.
All right. They didn't even try a rhyme there. I guess
so
that's better.
So do stop believing.
God, we do have to talk about, speaking of the end of Act 1, how, and again, in terms of just construction of a story or of a play, I get one big number about like all the dresses and montage. And I will say, they really did gag the girls with the quick changes. They really,
they're great. William Ivy Long, we got to give
William
him a shout
Long,
out.
Yeah,
incredible costumes.
He did some great costumes for it.
The way that she is changing outfits behind a crowd, like seamlessly, that is genuinely impressive.
Genuinely impressive. And then we get to Act 2, and then we get the feckety, 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 feck you dress again. Uh-huh. And we sort of do the same story where it's like, I can't fight him with my mind, so I'm going to fight him with my body of outfits.
The endless, like, pause for where applause would be when, like, the actor who's playing the bodyguards first says, like, fuck you, dress, like, knowing that if there were an audience there, this is where they're supposed to be screaming. But there's nobody there. So he's just standing, like,
breathing. Such a bizarre experiment of a Netflix.
Like, they just should have waited. I mean, it's just so funny that they pushed this out. Like, obviously, it was supposed to be 2020. It was supposed to coincide with a season of The Crown, I'm pretty sure. Mm. Then, accidentally, we'll talk about Spencer after this. But, like, that was coming out the same also in 2021.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it just, I mean, I think I wrote in that piece, Hillary, that you quoted, like, I know this is rich coming from Vanity Fair, but, yes, like, maybe we should be done with this. like this could be the tipping point.
Let her be dead.
Yeah,
enough
please,
is enough.
For the love of God. Yeah.
Yeah. I was also just blown away by how, and maybe there's a way to do a musical about one person. I mean, we really just got Here Lies Love, which is just came to Broadway, sure, which is about Imelda Marcos and, mm-hmm, sort of her, the life and times, and that's sort of problematic for many reasons involving the Marcoses. But
they killed people, is that what you're talking about?
Just a couple. There has to be a way to write a musical that isn't just entirely exposition. That, mm-hmm, this was just, it felt so, yeah, exterior and so like, here's a Wikipedia page thing, here's this. And we hit all of the major moments, sort of, or many of the major moments in her life. And, you know, we casually reference her bulimia, and we have a postpartum depression song and, yeah, and whatnot. But it all felt like exposition in a way that I would say Evita doesn't feel that way, because the main Evita has a very strong driving force of a goal to conquer the world.
I guess it's helpful that there's a narrator.
Yes,
maybe.
And maybe that would make it feel less like exposition. I was like, I cannot believe
you'd be able to have people having a conversation and not just like describing their intentions.
Yes. Like, what happened when she went to Wales and shook people's hands?
It's funny, though, having just watched this season of The Crown and then watching this and seeing how many of the same details get pulled into so many of the same, like, Diana. Like, she mentions, like, her face was on the tea towel, so she can't, like, pull out of the wedding. Like, that's a line that Elizabeth Debicki also says when she's talking to Dodi on the yacht. Like, there's a point at which maybe you've consumed too much Diana media and you notice that you're the, like, same thing, the same
beats. Oh, it's the tea towels thing again.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
So you guys are saying you want Sarah Ferguson in an armchair reading an old storybook, like, in the corner of the stage.
Why didn't Barbara...
Let me tell you about my sister-in-law. Like,
I want her as Barbara Cartland.
Yes.
Narrating...
Oh, there you go. Yeah.
Narrating the whole entire thing.
Yeah.
Give it the romance novel treatment.
Drowsy Chaperone style.
Yes. Man in chair down...
Right. It all comes to life in her living room.
This is
Buckingham Palace.
Such a more interesting concept.
We should literally write this musical.
New World Stage is called They Want Our Show.
Right next to the bubble show.
Yeah. Still watching from Vanity Fair, we'll be back in just a moment. And when we return, more on our Diana retrospective as we talk about Pablo Larraín's Spencer.
I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go. There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. But on Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's a new podcast from NPR where I invite actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to talk about some of life's biggest questions. Listen to Wildcard wherever you get your podcasts, only from NPR.
I've been imagining how they'll write about me in 1,000 years. I feel royal. The more time that passes, the fewer words they use to describe you. William the Conqueror. Elizabeth the Virgin. Diana. Insane?
Should we switch then to Spencer? Because that is a decidedly different approach. And I think it's one, actually, that, Chris, you were kind of getting at. Like, how do you do this when it's just all exposition? Mm-hmm. And Pablo Larraín and Kristen Stewart were like, how about no exposition? Yes.
Which is so refreshing.
So great. I was like, oh, finally, with all these different pieces of Diana media, we get something about her interiority.
Yeah.
Something from her perspective that makes us, while not historically accurate, makes us feel the way that she felt.
She didn't really see the ghost of Anne Boleyn.
That's real.
That's real.
Because that's also in... the musical, right? Yeah.
Got it.
And also, there were ghosts on The Crown.
Yeah. Okay. When Six and Diana, sort of that mashup, that happens. It's actually not a bad idea. But, you know, her eating the pearls, you know, and the soup, mm-hmm, and choking down at, mm-hmm, the fancy dinner and trying to keep it. That, like, really, oh, it's like you can feel the pain and the angst and the eyes on her and the wealth, the stifling of the family, mm-hmm, and how it affects her physically, where I know a lot of people complain about it, but I remember watching it in theaters and I was like, this is fascinating. And Pablo Larraín, it's not for everybody, but he is for me, and he knows how to portray a glamorous woman in distress.
Well, yeah. I felt like Jackie was maybe too experimental for me, but
that's
this
fair.
But this is like, you know, it's a linear story and it's told in a less of like a narrative driven way and more of a mood. But yeah, it was really effective for me too. And Kristen Stewart's so good.
Yeah, she is good. I mean, I rewatched it for this and I was a little bit less impressed by her performance, but that's only because I'd already seen it, I think.
Yeah. And because Elizabeth Debicki, like, is a tough act to follow also.
And I think there's also, you know, the meta angle of Kristen Stewart doing that. You know, Kristen Stewart, who has been through her own, I mean, nothing to the extent of Diana, but, like,
For the 21st century.
That started when she was a teenager and, you know, involved romantic scandal and whatnot. So you're kind of watching Kristen Stewart do it, whereas with Debicki, you're just watching,
an actress.
But I think, I think that Spencer is successful. Obviously, like you said, Chris, it's not for everybody.
My mom, for example, hated it.
But in zeroing in on this pivotal moment, her decision to leave. So there is, you know, there is a narrative to it. There is exposition to it. But it's just, it's narrow in its focus, big in its psychological scope, but plot-wise doesn't have to tell us about the tea towels and about this and about that and about that. It's just
doesn't
like, no.
Doesn't really have to say, like, yes, Charles, like, who is the Prince of Wales? I would marry you. Like, Diana married him when she was 19. Like, all of that is
we don't need that context. Anyone who's going to see Spencer is walking in with that context. And I think I like that the movie trusts that in a way the musical certainly does not trust any knowledge that no one's even familiar with the website Wikipedia.
or is familiar with, like, the notion that there's a country named England.
right. Basically, they're, like, pointed to a map. So this island here. But I think that what the movie could in some ways be about anyone leaving an oppressive marriage. Mm-hmm. You know, it is specifically about Diana and her legacy and her lore. But I think that they leave it kind of broad enough as a mood piece to be like, this is what it feels like to make the decision to get out of something bad, mm-hmm. which I think is good to kind of make it further, like make Diana's story more applicable or relatable, I guess, to other people.
Yeah. Well, without also sacrificing any of the aesthetic or, you know, the castles and all the things that we so associate with Diana and the royal family. So it gives that little, it broadens the scope and makes it more universal while still giving that zhuzh of you know, royal class and high
aesthetics.
And
gives it like a cool, like, genre edge too, where, you know, it's a haunted house movie in a lot of ways. And that is a version of this story that is not told over and over again.
Well, and I think that's a good segue to, like, talk about, like, these different depictions of Diana. We have Diana the musical, which is where she's kind of like a naive, lovesick, you know, person.
She's frequently just kind of standing there,
commenting on events that are happening around her. But
Spencer is making her a sort of cool but miserable person who is maybe cracked in the head a little bit, you know. And by all accounts, Diana did have a lot of psychological problems and, you know, whatnot. The Crown is showing her as pretty nice together, still sort of in love with Charles. What version do we kind of believe the most? I mean, I'm assuming Diana the musical for all three of us, right?
Obviously.
Well, I guess there's also Naomi Watts' version. Like, I don't know. I think for me, I'll say, like, I find for all of its artful strangeness, I think that the Spencer version is the one that I buy the most, I guess.
As a depiction. So I would say The Crown isn't really super concerned with Diana's interiority or Diana's experience. It's more about Diana and her effect on the Crown and the family and the Crown's effect on Diana, but she's a cog in a greater machine. Uh-huh. So I also agree with you that the only one that really gives us sort of an insight or a picture into what the day-to-day life of Diana might have been or what might have been going on internally, which I think at this point, now that we're, you know, 30 years out of from the accident or about that long, and we know the story, we know the beats, we know the story, we have a Wikipedia page, I'm more interested in that exploration than Diana, you know, sort of standing around belting all the events of her life, which I love that, you know, but that's not as compelling. Or the Crown's version, which is, how did Diana affect the Crown and the Crown?
I would push back on that a little bit, though, because I think that the Crown does show several sides of her, which it can because she's on it for three seasons. Like, there's just a lot more time to explore the various facets of her, to show her, like, manipulating the press and, like, letting them manipulate her, like, to show how, at least at the beginning, she did, you know, actively pursue a place in the royal family and, like, knew how to, like, that she wasn't just a victim, that she had agency and that she had aims and goals and was not just kind of, like, swept up in this fairy tale, which is, I guess, the Diana the musical version of it. Like, I think that The Crown does show us that there are several ways to look at her and that there are ways in which, like, yeah, she made her own fate and was also a victim of it. But
yeah, I think also the thing that I think draws me more to the Pablo Larraín version over the Crown version is that, like, Peter Morgan is never going to allow for a depiction of Diana to reveal the haunted house ghouls that she was surrounded by.
Yes, that is definitely...
Like, Crown is not going to be as critical. I mean, because Spencer, the movie, is like, no, these people are all, like, terrifying freaks.
And she needs to get out.
And they're weighing her when she walks into the house.
Stone.
Like a little fun tradition.
That's a real...
That is a real thing.
She's got to get out and get McDonald's and drive away from that haunted house.
They get KFC.
Okay, sorry.
And there's that beautiful liberation of that final moment in Spencer that's also so sad. And I think that moment is sadder than anything that Crown did with the Diana stuff.
Yeah, although the soundtrack finally goes from the free jazz to like the 80s pop that she loves.
Yeah, and then she's driving fast and, you know, it's cool. And I don't know.
She's driving a convertible on December 26th.
Well, right.
As we're in England, as we're all want to do.
Yes.
I don't know. I think that maybe I'm too sold on my idea of the royals as being these, you know, absolute horror shows who are completely incapable of expressing human emotion to each other. Maybe The Crown's version is more fair in that regard. It just doesn't really match up with how I see them, especially in the light of what we know about Meghan Markle and all that stuff.
Also fair, yeah. Although I do think it's interesting that in both Spencer and Diana the musical, Queen Elizabeth herself is kind of ultimately a sympathetic figure,
which
is not what you would necessarily expect from something that has a critical view of the monarchy. Like, in Spencer, initially, she's, you know, this, like, zombie who, like, doesn't speak and looks, you know, like, completely inhuman. And then as the movie goes on, she actually, she kind of comes to respect Diana. It's sort of like a... It's like the diner scene or something. It's like, you're not so different, like, you and
game,
I. Like,
organized game.
Yeah, now that you're, like, making a move to, like, I respect your moxie or whatever.
Yeah, and maybe there's a little envy in there, too.
Yeah.
You know, like, I just had to do this, and I didn't realize that there was a way that I could.
Because she was an officer's wife.
Yeah, an officer's wife.
Right.
As we heard time and time again at the end of the musical.
And then the king died.
Do we think there's any room in the coming, let's say, decade for another Diana story?
I don't know. It's pretty well
trod. It feels
well
like we're tapped out. That sounds like there's got to...
Ryan Murphy hasn't done it yet. That's all I'm saying.
Oh, well, now that you spoke that into existence.
You can see why that was the original plan for a season of Feud, though, because, like the OJ story, there is just so much to divine out of Diana. Like, you can use her true life saga to explore any number of topics that we cannot stop talking about, you know, and there's gender and there's wealth and there's power and there's
media.
Yeah, media. Mm. There's all of these, and it's actually all the same topics, I guess, which is sort of funny.
No, it is. I mean, it does make sense that that's what he would gravitate toward. I wonder what the thinking was behind not. Maybe it was
I think it's like
how do you do one season?
Yeah, like Jennifer Lawrence said, like, she's not going to make her Elizabeth Holmes movie because Amanda Seyfried did it and it was great, and like, we don't have to do it again in the next year.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
I would like to not have a lack of imagination and be like, okay, Diana is over. But it does feel like we could take that lens and put it on some other people.
Sarah Ferguson waits by the phone.
Yeah.
But I guess you have to get into Prince Andrew,
there's a story to tell there, though.
This is probably sacrilege, but it would be kind of interesting in, let's say, in like 15 years or something, some crazy person is just like, I'm going to make a movie where she's the villain. You know, that's a different angle of attack, you know.
Wait, if somebody makes Camilla, like Camilla exclamation.
Camilla.
That's what it is. That's what it is.
You make the Camilla.
That's what you've got to do next.
Yeah, because now we've seen her as, you know, silent villain sort of in so many different iterations.
Well, what's weird is that she's like the most sympathetic character in the Diana musical.
Yeah, the musical, she's the... Well, that's in part because Aaron Davey is so wonderful.
She's really good.
She has so much emotion. Like, she actually seems like a person.
Yeah, she seems like a person. And they do a good job. I mean... Until they put them in a literal boxing ring and they have that and they fight, which, you know, let's take that subtext and put it into the
Oh, there's no subtext,
stage.
Baby.
But again, all of these pieces of media really do paint Camilla and Charles as like really in love, and which seems to be true. And at least in The Crown, the musical, Diana, the musical, they give Camilla a fair, she's like the third lead. They give her a lot of space to sort of, you know, not just be like wicked stepmother who stole Diana's man.
And that's the story you haven't heard, except many, many times. Okay, well, good. I'm glad we had this discussion because, you know, we hadn't quite talked enough about Diana. But no, but as it goes to show, there is still a lot to be said.
Yeah, we didn't even touch on Naomi Watts.
I know, that's
true. I mean, that's not worth
it. We'd have to watch it.
That movie is just plain awful. And it's not fun like Diana the Musical. No. So we don't, if you're listening to this and you want to be a Diana completist, I cannot recommend you watch Diana.
Stop at Diana the Musical.
Well, that does it for this episode of Still Watching from Vanity Fair. We're going to get back into part two of the final season of The Crown on December 14th. Until then, you can find me on X and Instagram at Rylaws, R-I-L-A-W-S. Sometimes, someday I will stop saying ugh after that and just admit that.
I'm going to do a supercut of your disdain.
I doubt that you will one day stop doing that. And you can find me on X and on Instagram at Chris Triss, and I really do open any and all comments about Diana the Musical in my DMs, so please reach out.
You can find me at Hillabuster with two R's. And yeah, sure, I'd like to talk about Diana the Musical. I'm not made of stone. So this has been Still Watching from Vanity Fair. Our producer is Emily Elias. We had production help from Peyton Hayes. We had technical assistance from Gabe Quiroga. Steven Valentino is our executive producer. Our theme music is by Alexis Quadrado. We will be back with recaps of episodes 5, 6, and 7 of The Crown on December 14th. Looking forward to seeing you then.
Hi, I'm Michael Calori, the co-host of Wired's Gadget Lab.
And I'm Lauren Good, the other co-host of Wired's Gadget Lab. Get ready to dive deep into the cultural phenomenon that's been shaping conversations, sparking movements, and breaking barriers for over a decade.
The new three-part docuseries, Black Twitter, A People's History, based on the groundbreaking Wired cover story by Jason Parham, explores everything from the fun, games, and inside jokes that characterize the early years of Black Twitter to the social movements, the voices, and the hashtags that made Black Twitter an influential force in nearly every aspect of American political culture. Join us as we unravel the threads of this digital community, tracing its origins, celebrating its triumphs, and exploring its impact on society at large.
Watch the series from Onyx Collective in association with Wired Studios, premiering on Hulu on May 9th.